This is the Boundless Pursuit Podcast, a show highlighting the purity of the experience without limitation. Each week, we'll bring anglers as diverse as the fish they chase, whether it be from your backyard or your bucket list. Freshwater, saltwater, conventional gear, or fly. We're bringing stories and perspectives from fishermen from all walks of life, from across the country and globe. In the digital age, authentic communication and networking is critical, and I'd love to hear from you about show suggestions, potential guests, or general feedback. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com or at my website, www.boundless-pursuit.com. That's where you'll find the entire collection of written articles, podcast episodes, and media. I deeply value the feedback, ratings, reviews, and support of my listeners, and I look forward to hearing from you. I'm your host, David Graham. Now let's get on to today's episode. I've had the pleasure of talking with fishermen from all over the country and around the world on this podcast, just being genuinely interested in the culture behind different fishing styles and approaches. I just love seeing how other people do it. But of all of them, though, I haven't found a culture with such a deep passion, history, and dedication for the hunt quite like the surf fishermen from Montauk. For generations, anglers have flocked to the rocky shorelines of Montauk in hopes of catching a narrow bite window or the coveted 50-pound striped bass. And it's a pursuit that has driven these guys to insanity and pushed anglers to take extreme measures, daring to navigate rough seas and tides in waders and wetsuits. And my guest today is cut from that cloth. Brandon Saucily is a 7-time Montauk Surf Masters champion. He's a relatively young angler, but seasoned in his experience and a genuine appreciation for the long culture of this style of fishing. And Saucily is just a different breed from what I'm accustomed to. Donning a wetsuit and specialized gear, the guy spends countless hours, odd hours, studying, logging, and timing acute windows of ideal moon phases, tide cycles, and bait migrations, and boldly stepping off ledges into waters, just hoping that calculations and experience line up enough that, you know, he might be carried out to scattered rock edges that he can get a loose foothold on to make a cast through pounding seas. Incredibly badass and just undeniable displays of dedication and passion. Such so that I think it transcends just the fish. And so in this conversation, I'm taking the position of a guy on the outside looking in at this insanity with genuine interest. I'm curious. And we talk about getting started in this game, a proper introduction, and a proper graduation to the point of taking these extreme risks in a calculated way. We talk about the migratory routes of the fish, the seasonal patterns, the effect or the relevance of tide and moon cycles, and how all of these factors have to be internally or externally documented and logged in order to even recognize patterns and predictability. We talk about some of the gear that's used and precautions that have to be taken, because you can't be lackadaisical in this style. Everything needs to be smart and polished mentally and physically. It's an awesome conversation with a badass dude talking about the past, present, and the foreseeable future of the Montauk surf casting scene. This is Montauk surf angler Brandon Saucily. But I've never been up there, but like I said, I've got buddies that live up there. I know guys who used to live up there that live down here now. And I'm just one of those guys that, like, I don't know, I'm real interested in different kinds of fishing geographically, like in the States and even like overseas. Whether or not I'll get the chance to do them all, probably not. There's like stuff in Alaska that I'd like to go do. Like within the States, though, there's like ones that I really want to do, like ice fishing. And like what you do, I really want to do. But I'm like, I don't know. It's like, I feel like that's not one you can just go do on your own. Like you got to know somebody. You got to be with people who know what they're doing because it looks dangerous as hell. Yeah. I don't know. It's like very tribal up there, it seems. Like maybe I get on the wrong turf or something. So.
A way to kind of dip your feet into it. And like I tell guys, I'm like, hey, like if you want to come out, and they're like, oh, no, I can't swim like that. And you just, you know, there's closer rocks. You don't have to swim. I tell you, half the guys out there, you know, there's a whole Montauk scene. It's been like that for decades, but I've only been fishing out there for like, I don't know, hard for like 8 years, maybe. Hard. But a lot of the guys before me are starting to, not slow down, but there's a new generation, which is my generation. And for some reason, they're not big into swimming like the old generation. The sharks are turning them off, and they don't, they're not grinding the same way, you know, we started out, or I started out, where you know, no one wants to talk to you out there. They look at you and they don't say a word. And it's almost become like they only come to Montauk when they hear there's a bite out in Montauk.
Oh, I got you.
Yeah, because all of Long Island sees the migration, you know, from spring and fall. So you'll have guys that, you'll have some of the best fishermen that are just like, nah, there's no need to go to Montauk. It's an hour and a half away, whatever it is. But I just like it. If you ask any guys that fish Montauk, you know, hard, I know this guy, Bill Wetzel, he does charters out there.
Yeah.
I'll say the same thing. It's like,
I've seen his stuff. I've listened to some of it because like, he kind of makes his rounds and some of the podcast stuff and videos. So I've seen his stuff, but yeah.
Yeah. He's a lifer, you know, he's been there since whatever, fishing there for 40 years, but he says the same thing. It's just different catching them on the rocks. Like even if there's fish up island, we just want to go out there, and he doesn't even wetsuit. He wears waders out there. So it just draws people, you know, drew me out there. But
yeah. Well, I look at that style of fishing. Like I said, I've talked to a lot of different fishermen, at least on this little platform here, from all over the world, who do all different kinds of styles of fishing. But it's like, this is like one of those ones that I'm interested in because I know that there's like a progression. At least when I look at that, I'm like, you can't just start in that. I don't know. I think that there's a respect level involved. Like, I don't know, man. It's like there's a lot of different kinds of fishing, but not a lot of different kinds of fishing have like a culture behind it, like a deep rooted historical culture behind it. Not a lot of fishing does it, at least not on to the same degree that I've seen in that. I was like watching this video earlier today and some yesterday when I should have been working. I think it was called like Montauk Rocks or something like that. It's like an hour long video.
Yeah.
Of these like old heads talking. I was like, it just doesn't seem like one of those things that somebody's going to want to show up on day one and put on a wetsuit. And I'm looking at the water that y'all get in. I'm like, yeah, like this is a type of fishing that demands like a graduation, or like demands you to actually like put in hours, put in miles, like and put in time to get to the point where even worthy or have the balls to go do some of the shit that I see you doing. I'm like, what? And I look at that crap and I'd love to do it, but I'm not an idiot either. Like I couldn't, you know, you got to start somewhere. So I'm assuming there's like a kiddie pool version. If you're going to take somebody that's new to it, like, all right, we'll take them to the kiddie pool.
But, just generally, you have the north side of Montauk and the south side, 'cause it's a point. So you can go. The north side is a little calmer water. It's the Block Island Sound. It's you don't have to swim out to as many rocks, and you could fish a rip right from shore. Like, you don't need to push out. You can. And then there's the south side, which is basically just, you know, the Atlantic Ocean reefs, your typical reefs and coves, you know, a point and a cove. And the south side's where most of the, you know, beatings happen, most of the swimming and intense, then there's a whole other aspect of fishing a storm. I'm sure you've seen us fish nor'easters and stuff.
Yeah.
That's on the side, and that's, you know, getting your teeth kicked in for hours on end. It really just how bad you want, you know, whatever you're going after, a big fish or a tournament or both.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know, when as a guy on the outside looking in, I grew up in the South. Like, like I said, I've never even traveled through that area. But I look at that and I can see, like, a lot of people aren't going to want any part of that. Like, you look at that, it's scary.
Yeah.
Not to make myself sound like a wimp, but I look at that, I'm like, I can see why the it's a small community. You know what I mean? It's like, it's, I don't know. I look at that and I'm like, it's got to be tough. But I also, then I look at the people who are doing it and some of the photos that you have, and you wonder, like, how do you get started doing that? Like, you're going to need a lot of information resources. You're going to I wouldn't think you'd want to learn by trial and error. Let me just figure out what'll happen if I get into this water on this tide and it starts pulling me out, and hopefully there's a rock out there in the middle of the night. Like, maybe there's guys, I'm sure there's like the forefathers of this game that somebody had to be the first one to go out there. But I guess if we're going to start somewhere good, you always want to start with like the origin stories, but I never liked those podcasts where they're like, all right, so how did you start fishing? You got to like go through that. But I do want to know, like, the early days where at some point, I'm assuming you didn't start as a kid in that style of fishing. I don't know if you started as like a pond hopping for bluegills and that at some point you end up out in these giant breakers. But like, I don't know, man. Like, where did you get started? Who, if there was a mentor of some sort, whether it be your dad or some local, like, how did you get started in that style of fishing?
So basically I'm further up Long Island in like the North Shore. So here's my origin story. I did grow up just like fishing like small bass, stuff like that. But Montauk was, even for me, Montauk's an hour and a half drive. It's this, and it's a whole different allure to it. That when I was younger, you go with my mom. Sometimes she'd take me and my buddy out. We go fishing and we'd see Paulie's tackle is, he's now closed, but he had all the oars up for the tournaments. He was weighing big fish, and you just see this shit and you're like, I want to do that. I want to catch a fish like that. That guy's in a wetsuit. So it kind of started my driver's license. And from there, I was just, you know, I was just going to the rocks. But I did really start kind of with trial and error, you know. I would just go into Paulie's in the morning, tell him about my night, and, you know, give it a go the next night. But it's got your basic points and your basic holes where you could say, you know, that, you know, is generally where you want to start out, on the edge of a cove or whatever.
Yeah.
But you start, you know, you get your first wetsuit, you want to start safely, nor'easters, but you start bumping into guys out there that might show you a thing or two. But I really didn't get any mentors like that, partly because I joined the tournaments early on. So a lot of the guys out there, the heavy hitters and the old timers, they don't want to bring you in and have you beat them in the tournament, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I actually just wrote an article about finding rocks. It's kind of what you're getting at here. It's like, how do you go about finding a rock, or go about, you know, just deciding I'm going to go swimming or whatnot. And a lot of it's seeing, you know, observing guys out there, you know, even because, you know, Montauk's getting less and less populated with fishermen, but there you'll still get a crowd or a couple, you know, guys that hit hard every night. So you start fishing and you see the guy always out there. And you're like, oh, there's a rock out there. I'm going to pick the next calm night and I'm going to try and get it. And, you know, and then eventually he'll float by you and say, hey man, what's your name? And then you start talking, but
yeah,
it's definitely, but there is, people do get into it, by having a mentor, or actually Bill Wetzel is a guide. So he does surf guides. I know, a handful of guys that, would charter Bill like years ago. And that's how they got started in Montauk, and now they hit it hard. But so there's different ways, but a lot of people get addicted to it out there, you know?
Yeah, I see it. I kind of see that. It's almost like you'd have to take little teeny little bits of snippets of notes based on things you observe, because, you know, I don't know, going back to watching that video, it doesn't look like everybody, and people shouldn't be an open book.
Yeah.
Especially if you had to work your ass off to gain the knowledge, you don't want to just give it away for free. So, you know, I get that. You have to be intuitive enough as an individual to be able to read a lot on little cues. So, I get that. But, you know, when I look at that style of fishing and the fish that you're chasing, I guess is mostly the striped bass. I see a little bit of bluefish in there, but the striper, I mean, that's a species of fish that runs all up and down the Atlantic. But for whatever reason, that's, I don't know, that region is like the Mecca. Like, so I wonder why, like, what is it? I don't know. Like, what geographic features, like, why are they funneling in that area so thick? Are they still funneling in there that thick? I mean, what makes Montauk so special, and why does that seem like the spot that all these monster stripers seem to be gravitating to?
So those fish will start down south in the Chesapeake, and they'll start in the Hudson. Actually, they'll breed up there. But Montauk is along their migration route, you know, they go from west to east against Long Island, and then they go even further north. But what makes Montauk special is it's actually a residency, they call it, for bass. Bass will stay there the whole year long.
Oh, okay.
So you'll get, you know, a body of fish, the migrators that come through Montauk, and then you'll get a percentage of them that'll sit in those rips until September. So, you know, you really got a shot at them the whole year if you know what how to play it.
Yeah. What are they migrating for their own spawn, or are they just following like bait fish? So what's driving them to move up the coast in the first place?
It's a good, I think it has to do with water temps. If they stay in the Chesapeake the whole year, you know, I'm sure how hot it gets down there, but they breed down there. They travel further north, and then they come back down to breed again. And they'll actually breed in the rivers in the Connecticut, the Housatonic and whatnot, and some rivers up north. But actually, they go further. They're going further north every year with warmer water temperatures. So I think it's more, you know, temperature related. They'll go as far as, you know, guys are catching them in Maine and Nova Scotia. But, you know, a lot of it's bait driven, too. You know, time of year. You know, they'll follow the bunker, they'll follow the sand eels, or, you know, but I'd say mostly, you know, the inherent biological clock of them to migrate along with water temps, you know?
Right. It seems like there's like a little bit of a difference in, because I've been watching these videos just even in preparation for this conversation. I was like, you know, trying to watch videos of that style of fishing. It's like, there's two different things going on. Like, I'll see these like blitzes right at their feet, and like the whole water's exploding, but the fish don't look that big. It's like a class of fish, I'm guessing. Are there still giant ones mixed in with that? Or is it kind of like fish of certain size classes are moving together? Like, where I see these giant blitzes of 10, 15 pound fish, are those big 50 pound, like the coveted monster ones, traveling in that same mass group? Are they on their own thing?
So you're exactly right. The majority of those blitzes are a different body of fish on a different bait. And you know what it is? It's a lot of small white bait, they call it, like bay anchovies and smaller bait. They call it the white bait blitzes.
Okay.
You'll have ember, you know, you got bait like this. And like you said, you're lucky if you get a 15 pounder, but guys know that they're getting into. I mean, you know, sometimes someone might stick a slob out of nowhere, but it's usually, you know, consistently the same size fish, and it's called blitz fishing, and people go there for that. They know they're not going to get the trophy, but those fish are around, you know, at night, like on a different type of bait. You know, if that body's during the day on white bait, maybe at night they're on juvenile weak fish or bunker on the south side or something.
Yeah.
If you're big fish hunting, it's usually not going to be in those blitzes like that. However, there's been a couple occasions where you're like, you get some end of the migration July where you get some blitzes of trophy fish that people remember forever, but majority going to be your smaller fish.
Yeah. See, my problem, if I came up there, would be, yeah, I don't know, it's probably a discipline thing, but like, you know, and we get the similar things here in Florida where like a big school of jack starts going crazy. It's like your game plan was to go out for one type of fish, a bigger fish, but then you got all this guaranteed catch going on beside you. It's like, well, do you want to catch the big fish or do you want to like catch a certain, you know, where you're absolutely going to catch fish? It was like, I'd get too caught up in all the little ones that were everywhere and play the game of numbers. But yeah, I don't know. I looked at those videos and I'm wondering then if they're moving in classes like that, I guess that makes sense. They're more chasing the size bait fish. So wherever the smaller bait is, where the smaller fish are, wherever the bigger bait is, where the bigger fish are. But are you kind of able to predict, like, are these the same fish that'll be back 10 years from now at a bigger size? Like, is it cyclical to the point that this year we seem to have a giant class of small fish? So we can forecast that, I don't know what their growth rate is, but we can forecast in 5 years, 10 years, we're going to have a great class of giant trophy sized fish.
Yeah, that's exactly the theory. You know, year classes of fish, they call it. You want to see healthy, like, teen-sized fish in 20s, but sometimes when you have all fit 40s and all micro bass, it's not really a healthy population. But they will be more or less the same fish. They've done some tag studies where, you know, the fish goes up, you know, along Long Island, up towards Maine, and then back to the Chesapeake, and then does it again. And guys used to have what they call resident fish. Like I said, they stay in Montauk the whole year, but they get fish that stay at the same reef. They keep coming back to the same reef, you know, like that. They're pretty, they'll have resident fish at certain, like, structure points. But that's slowly turning, you know, from, because the population's not doing too well, that there's not many resident, as many resident fish, rather. But yeah, like you were saying, there's different year classes of fish. And I think, I don't know if you know the regulations, but it was basically until 2020. So when I first started out, it was like one at, I don't know, you can keep one above 28 inches or something, and you can keep your trophy fit. Okay. And with the population going down, their solution was, you know, to make a slot limit so you can't keep trophies and you can only keep 28 to 35 inches or something. In theory, since that year, you know, the fish have gotten bigger. Like you're saying, the 40s or the 30s from last year, think are the 40s I'm seeing the next year, and the 50s possibly the year after that, if they're theoretically they can't be killed, you know.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, that was the next thing I was going to ask, because if you're trying to preserve the size class of fish, like, you would want to, I don't, you know, you'd want to limit the amount of harvest of the smaller fish that are going to eventually turn into bigger fish. But, you know, in watching even that video that I was mentioning, I saw these, like, practices that used to be in place. I don't know what the commercial scene looks like up there, but I was, like, watching these videos about how they'd run these long nets, or they'd run these long lines, even from the beach, run these long lines and selling the fish. And, like, is that still a thing there? I mean, are you having to contend with, like, I know the big thing off the Chesapeake, some of my buddies that fish that area is, like, what do they call them? It's like the industry that's, they're not taking the striped bass or the redfish or any of that shit. They're taking the food source. They're, like, over harvesting all the bunker. They're over harvesting all the food, and it's, yeah, like, driving the fish away. But, like, has there been any kind of noticeable impact commercial wise directly on the fish or the bait that y'all are dealing with, or have they started taking this whole thing more serious in recent times?
The commercial guys can still keep you know, a good amount of fish. They have their slot limit too, or their size limit. But mostly in the fall, for whatever reason, you will get guys, you know, boats that are setting up their nets at the same vicinity that you're fishing. And you might have a bite of big fish for a whole week, and they set their net for 2 days, and it ends. I don't know if it's coincidental. People argue on both sides, but. And then the bunker, like you're saying, bunker is a big driving force of the bass up here, you know, food source. And I know one boat was, there was some controversy with over harvesting a bunker maybe a year or so ago. And, you know, it does affect them, you know, it does affect the migration and the fishing.
Yeah. Yeah. That, when I, the more I started going down the rabbit hole of looking at the style of fishing that y'all do up there, the more I was like, geez, like that's not one of those things I would think that you can just internalize. Maybe it is with a certain amount of experience, but I started listening to these guys talking about moon phases and wind directions and certain tides and certain this and that and times of year. I'm like, that is a lot of crap to balance and to keep track of. Like, I'm not the type of guy that can internalize stuff. I have to put things on paper. Like, did you find that you had to start doing that? Because I was like, I mean, there's so many variables to have to pattern a fish like that. That's so cyclical. And there's all these things have to line up exactly perfect to get this one bite window that might be this odd hour that could only last for 30 minutes. How did you get to the point where you started like closing in on that and be like, this is a pattern that I've seen over the course of years. And it always seems like this specific set of conditions has been the most fruitful. Do you like maintain a log of some sort?
Yeah. So a detailed log. And part of all those reasons you're saying is why people get obsessed about striped bass. It's just, you know, there's so many variables that you need to write it down if you're serious about it. And the amount of times that, you know, prior logs have helped me win tournaments or catch a big fish and being the sole reason I went that night or whatever. It's untold the amount of times that's happened. So I keep a detailed log. I'd say moon phase is a big one for me. Moon phase and time of year. Like, I don't know. First off, I'll say in this fishery, at least your best log is it maybe 2 years back, but I use the year prior as my best source of information. I don't, you know, guys will use 10 years ago and they'll go to the spot that they, you know, there should be a big bite here and there isn't, and they don't understand why. Mm-hmm. And it's just, you know, old patterns aren't playing out. So I use more recent logs, 1 to 2 years. And you look up, if I had fished July of 2020 on the new moon, now July of, you know, 2021 or whatever, the next year, the new moon falls on the end of July instead of the beginning. So now you have to debate, was the bite because of the new moon or was it the time in July that it was? So there's a lot of variables going on, but you still got to go almost all the time to to root out, you know, what it could be.
Yeah. Yeah. I get the allure for that. That's one of those things, like when I talk to somebody that doesn't fish, like my wife or somebody like that, and they're like, why the hell do you keep doing all that? Like the people at my work, you know, I'm spending all this money constantly on vacation just to go catch some damn fish. And they don't understand that. And I imagine that, like you sort of alluded to this, like it is about catching the fish to a degree, but it's like, I get more enjoyment out of validating like my instincts, if that makes sense. Like, exactly. I have this theory and I have this pattern that I think that I've established, and I set a game plan, and I think that if I'm here on this day under these conditions at this time, I'm going to catch the big fish. And when it happens, there's joy in getting a great photo, sure, but like the real like meat in all of it is that you just validated that you solved a puzzle is all you did. And it feels good, but
it doesn't even have to be the biggest fish, but you know, we'll have bites where maybe it's easy to catch a 30-pound fish or maybe someone else told you about the bite. You go down there, you have a 30, or sometimes you could be hunting that fish. It's been slow for 2 weeks. Your logbook tells you to come down and you catch the same size fish, but you just get to the shore and it just is like you won the World Series. It's just somewhat validating and, you know, fulfilling to find your own and to catch the way you want to catch it and to catch it, you know, like validating your own information, like you're saying.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think that it's also because you don't get a pattern on 3 successful trips or 4 successful. Yeah. Like a pattern is one of those things. It might take years and years and years before it starts. And then, like, to your point, sometimes the pattern, it's like, according to my playbook here, this shouldn't be happening. It's like, and then they throw you a monkey wrench. But I hear the guys always talk about moon phases. And, you know, that is a side of fishing that I've never understood very well or leveraged very much. Like, what is, you know, I don't guess I'm getting into trade secrets here, but like, what's the relevance of the moon? Is it more because of the brightness of the light in the sky, or how hard it's pulling the tide? Like, or is it both? Is it that like the fish can elude the predators when the moon is so bright that they can see them coming? Like, I've heard a lot of different theories, but like, what is the optimal moon, and what is the actual, like, what is happening moon phase wise? Like, what is the real effect on the fish?
So the light is not something we look for, because actually the full moons we don't like as much because it's too bright out. It's just whatever. But the moon itself is going to give you higher highs and lower lows and faster currents. So, you know, those are going to be the times that the big fish are coming in close into the surf, maybe. You know, they got faster currents, better advantage against the bait fish, and you have higher high tides. But also, the moons correlate to like a step in the migration. Okay. Like, if you, every month has two moons, usually a new and a full. If you took, you know, and you just spread it out from April to November, each moon phase, like, well, each full or new moon, the fish should be in this part, you know. They should be coming from the north now, because it's the October new moon. This is when they start going south from Block Island, or this is when they show up in Block Island into Montauk. It's just really like you said, patterns. Besides the advantage they have against the prey, it's almost part of their biological clock too, that, you know, ooh, we're looking for that July new moon bite. We know where they're going to be.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. That's out of it's interesting. You know, you've mentioned a couple of times, and I have it kind of here in my notes, because it was a side of it that I wanted to ask about, like the competitive side. So I was like, there's the competitive side where you're competing against yourself and your own ability to read the water. But then when you start talking about competition fishing, you know, I was reading a little bit about that. I thought, and maybe I saw old news, but at least at the time that I was reading about it, I saw where you had won this Montauk Surf Masters thing 7 times or something like that. Maybe you've won it a couple times since then, but at least 7 times. But like, what is the nature of the competition? Like, how does that work? I mean, that seems like that's a totally different scene for me. Like, I don't know who's judging. What's the criteria for winning? How do you enter? Like, what's that tournament scene look like?
So I would say tournament fishing is in the surf casting scene for bass is 50-50. People are either like, you know, I hate that. That's not fishing. That's, you know, going for glory or whatever. And some people love, like, I'm a competitive guy. I played some sports growing up and I love competition. When I first started hitting Montauk hard, it's an invite only tournament, the Montauk Surf Masters, and it's pretty much local guys. You didn't have to live in Montauk, but pretty much it's a local group of guys that compete against each other for the biggest fish of that spring or that fall. I think competitions have made me, you know, definitely a much better fisherman than if I wasn't. There's so many times where, you know, we're obviously driven to catch the monster fish, but there's so many times you're like, I don't feel like going out tonight. But the reason you do is because there's, you know, this competition on the line, someone else is going out, and you know, it just gives you that extra little motivation. There's guys in tournaments that I convinced to join in, and they caught the biggest bass of their life just because they fished more because they were in a. So I think it's definitely more than just winning. I mean, it brings out some, you know, motivation, you know, grit, and it brings out, you know, sometimes your personal best fish that you otherwise wouldn't have got if you weren't. Exactly. So
that's pretty cool. Do they have like subcategories of, you know, or is there only one way to win, get the most weight? Or do they have like, oh, you can get the biggest fish, you can get the most fish, you can get total weight? Is there like, hell, maybe there's even age categories.
I think there's a women's and a youth, but it's pretty much just, even for them, it's just biggest weight, you know?
Okay. I'm surprised I don't have a biggest fish. But so you talk about trophy fish. I guess that's a good one to kind of talk about, because like my experience with striped bass has always been like landlocked, you know, or up in little river systems, or, you know, the small ones. Very limited experience with striped bass personally. Like I've done some with river fish in the Santee system in South Carolina and shit like that, but not these monsters that live on the beaches. But like, what is considered, you know, every fish kind of has like its trophy class fish, but what's considered like, I don't know, like the top tier fish, like what is the, like the trophy mark? I don't know if it's in inches or by pounds or what.
We do all things by pounds when it refers to bass, usually, just because you get them in the fall and they've got 12 bunker in them. And yeah. I don't know, the inches, it varies. But we do pounds, and it would be 40 pounds is the first trophy mark. That's what you call a trophy bass, I would say. You know, a lot of people strive to hit a 40-pounder. Some never hit it. The next one up is 50. Which 50 Whoa. Is 50 is a monster fish. I just hit that this year, and people, you know, many people go their whole lives without doing that. And that really was my life goal.
Yeah.
And 60 is something that like you only hear of like there's only been one or two weighed in the Montauk. I think one in the Montauk tournament ever, you know. 60 is like you're approaching like record territory.
I guess that'd be the good. I guess that'd be the one good thing about kill tournaments, or like where you take them up. At least they be a little bit easier to catch somebody bullshitting. That side of it seemed cool to me. I like the idea of it being like the invite only, because I imagine you've probably seen the same faces.
Yeah,
that would be more interesting to me if you can establish like rivalries and stuff like that. Look at the same. You're always like kind of competing with the same people. As long as it doesn't get ugly, but yeah.
But it basically is, because a lot of the guys, you see the same few guys that are fishing hard in Montauk at night, and I imagine that's how it's originated. Like, hey, let's see who can catch the biggest. You know,
Well, that's always going to happen. There's always a little bit of ego involved with some fishermen, so it's going to turn into. It might be a silent competition, or it's out there. But you've mentioned a few times this waders versus wetsuiters versus, I don't know, you know. And I watched a little bit of that when I was watching the videos. It's like there's these different classes of people. The guys just get to the point where they start pushing these limits to like go further and further to get the fish. I'm like, God, some of these guys are nuts. But you know, I don't know. When I look at guys that are in waders, and I guess their limit is chest deep or hip deep. And then at some point people decided I'm going to put on a wetsuit and go swimming. What is it really giving a distinct advantage over the guys that are on dry land or a little bit in the breakers to go that far out? I mean, is it a like a night and day different thing, like a distinct advantage that you get, or is it more so the thrill of getting to a spot into where you're not having to share the water?
Yeah, there's a little bit of both. That's another hotly debated topic. There's so many, you know, some of the best fishermen in Montauk have been in waders, and a lot of guys will tell you, you know, Wetzel uses waders. You don't need to swim out there. It's unnecessary. My biggest fish are at my feet. I believe that, you know, a lot of the bigger fish I've caught are because I was further out. And, you know, sometimes people admit it, that there's a, you know, a bite that they can't reach because it's further out. But it just opens like so many different, you know, doors and avenues for fishing, because it's not even about swimming. You get there's a lot of rocks in Montauk where it's like, you know, just at your chest, but it's pretty close in. But if you have waders on, you just really can't finagle it, especially if there's a swell or not.
Yeah.
And being able to pop up in that wetsuit and fish, you know, I think it's a big advantage. And then if you take it far enough and you get to the outer rocks, I mean, you can reach fish that the boat guys are catching and that only the boat guys would catch. This spring, there was a big bite I found in June, and it was kind of that scenario. It was at a tip. It was at a tip of a point and end of the cast, top waters. And, you know, a lot of guys closer in weren't doing as well. And, you know, that's an example of, and there's been many times where, you know, there's guys behind me catching fish and I'm not. It all varies. You know?
Yeah.
I believe overall that, you know, pushing out has helped me. Because if you think about it in theory, out there off a reef, off the shores, it starts, you know, 10, 15, 20 feet. You get the mass majority of the fish are going up and down the reefs and whatnot in their schools. And the guys and the waders that are all the way on the shore, they're theoretically only getting the fish that wander out of that pack, let's say, and decide to come onto the reef to feed or whatnot. But if you're out there in the wetsuit, you might be able to reach fish that didn't even plan on coming in on the reef. They're still, you know, in their group or whatever.
Yeah. And
also, you get first pick of the of fish that are coming into the reef to feed on that tide. So I think there's definitely an advantage there. There's a lot of theory around it, a lot of, you know, back and forth, but
yeah. Well, I would think that there's beyond, you know, the literal being able to go out and get to fish that other people can't get. You know, I think it's like there is a big psychological wall you probably have to break through to get to the point to even put that suit on and go out to that rock. And if you make it to the rock, and especially if you get to the rock and find success, I talk about this, even the styles of fishing that I do, like mental conditioning on top of the physical conditioning, surely you're having to do to be able to swim out there. Like if you're some, you know, fat out of shape person that is like you're at risk of dying doing that. You can't do it. You don't get to go do that. But I would think that like just the very like reaching of the rock probably does a lot for like confidence. To let you know that like in hard conditions, I can push through. So there's obviously benefits that go beyond being able to actually catch the fish. And it's like, I think about things like that. So.
No, it turns it into like a contact sport, you know, it turns it into, you need some, you know, stamina, endurance. And that adds to that, what you were getting at earlier, that fulfilling feeling, you know, if you're there and you had to, you know, drift with the current and time it perfectly that you're hitting that rock and you're grabbing onto it and you're taking waves for four hours, then you catch that 30-pounder, 40-pounder, that's going to feel better than, you know, other ways you might catch
fish. Yeah, this is like the topic that I knew I'd get caught up on. Like when you're out there drifting towards these rocks, are your feet touching or are you literally, like, are you having to be so tactical with it, like, I would think you'd have to plan out, like, is the tide carrying you or are you physically swimming to the rocks? Is it like, all right, I got an outgoing tide that's going to drift me right past these rocks that I know are here. I can't be too far to the left. I can't be too far to the right or it might sweep me out to sea. Like, how are you game planning that? You know what I mean? Like
the majority of those real outside rocks, it's full swimming. There's, you know, no contact with the bottom. And it's exactly what you're saying. You got to time it. Luckily, so on the north side of Montauk is known for its rips. It has harder rips. So that planning it out is definitely more crucial going up. Sometimes a whole point over starting just to make your way by the time you get out 50 yards, 100 yards that you're in that general area. But the south side is, unless you're on a moon tide, you get less of that.
Okay.
Big rip. So you could even, you know, kind of tread around and look around and stuff, but you get a moon tide on the north side and you got to know that if you miss it, you got to swim all the way back to shore. Hit it again.
Because that's what I was thinking is like, if you're going with the tide to the rock, like if that thing is, you're riding it just to get there, I would think you pretty much have to commit. I didn't know if it was like to the point like, well, we're on this thing until the tide shifts because we can't get back. I didn't know if it was quite like that much of a commitment or, you know, what are you just able to swim down to the next way. You can't go back the way you came from, I would think.
Yeah, no, you could always get back to shore usually, unless there's been some stories, but I won't get into that. But the one thing you have to think of is there's a lot of rocks that you could only hold around low tide. So there is that whole, if we don't get off now, it's going to get sketchy, you know? Ooh. So you have to take into consideration the amount of water above the rock itself, you know?
Yeah. What are you wearing on your feet to swim? Like, are these big, heavy boots? I'd be worried about that.
Yeah.
Pulling you down, you know what I mean? All of this stuff, I'm like, you know.
Yeah.
I just think of the physical element of it. Is the suit you're in buoyant or something? Is it allowing you to float? Because I know some guys have like gear belts on, and if it weighs too much, that is working against you.
Yeah, you're not going to get much buoyancy, especially if you have a two-piece wetsuit like I do. But a lot of guys that aren't swimming will wear your typical, you know, wading boot with spikes in it if they're on top. Okay. But the guys like me, and there's a few other guys that are doing a lot of swimming, I personally do a wetsuit booty, like a little, you know, like a sock surfers wear.
Okay. And,
there's a type of spikes they call corkers that you could tie over your booty like a sandal.
Okay. And yeah.
It's just basically rubber with spikes in it, durable rubber, but it's not bulky. It doesn't get full with water. You know, it's definitely, yeah, it's almost like it enables you to move a lot easier. So yeah, I know guys that try and swim and they have the clunky Sims boots and it's just not flying, you know?
And what stroke are you using? You know what I mean? You got a rod in your hand. Are you butterfly stroking with a rod in your hand? Like you just holding the rod and pulling yourself with other, like, I don't understand the ability to even swim under those conditions. Or are you just floating?
So there's a few tactics. once you lose bottom, you could usually maintain contact with the rod at the bottom, the butt of your rod.
Okay.
An 11 footer, so we call that poling around. The south do that, like I was saying, big current, you kind of pole around, and you know, but the if you get a good rip, you're just moving with the tide. But I use a side stroke if I am swimming because I got my rod one hand. It's like kind of cupping and a scissor kick at the same time. That's what I would use. Some guys butterfly stroke back, kind of, but. Yeah.
So, you know, I think about preparation, like, there, you know, you got gear preparation and studying the tides and things like that. But it's like there's mental preparation. There's like knowledge preparation and educating yourself and reading. There's like time on the water. But like the physical monster that you're dealing with, like you have some sort of regimen for getting ready. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm assuming you had some kind of background in sports or something to even be geared competitively to want to do that kind of stuff. But are you literally going to like the local YMCA and like swimming or like, how are you getting prepared for that? Cause you can't be an idiot. Like I said, I think of a lot of the guys that I know who do not do any sort of physical conditioning at all. They just fish. You know what I mean? Like what are you doing to prepare yourself? I would just think you got to be smart to make sure you're physically capable. Cause I can't imagine being out there and like something goes wrong. And I grew up wrestling and I remember the feeling like when you start to burn out, it's the worst feeling ever. It's literally like you feel like you're drowning. Yeah. And like, there's this sense of inevitability. Like I'm done. I'm done. And I just can't imagine getting myself to that place out in the water.
No, it's just staying in shape, going to the gym and stuff like that and being smart. But you get to the point that if you're getting overweight or you're losing stamina, you either stop going to those outer rocks or decide to get in better shape, you know. But it is, you know, there's some close calls, you know, getting sucked out. There's time to lose your bearings in the fog. Swimming against current is always a no-go. You know, you're going nowhere and you're panicking. The sharks are a whole new thing, so that's another thing. That's a whole other topic.
Well, I have that one as a bullet point. I didn't know how much we'd get into it because it's sort of like, you know, that's just the age old thing that's going to get brought up anytime you talk about wading around out in the water. But I'm like, you know, I wonder how much of a hazard it really is. I guess if you're toting around, like I see some of the guys that have their fish on stringers against their legs. I mean, are the sharks really that big of a, are you losing a lot of fish to sharks right now? Is that a real issue? Or is it like, it happens every now and then. I'm not really worried about getting bit.
So it's a rather new problem, and it's it's actually getting worse every year. Like if you ask the old timers, they used to do a thing called skishing where they would just just fucking float and fish, no bottom, no rock, just floating fish. You can't do that nowadays because the sharks, people Ooh. Don't even do it anymore because of the sharks. It's just, I don't know, protecting endangered species or warmer waters, whatever it is, but there's a lot of sharks out there, and it's a real threat. You can't string or fish at all. They always get bit off. Eels, I try not to use an eel bag because it's just carrying a sack of eels on your hip.
Ooh, yeah.
And it's just being smart. I can't really say that because people call me the stupidest guy for still doing this shit, even though capturing videos of these massacres, but it's a summer thing usually. Around July, August is the worst, but you get nights that it's every bass you catch is getting bit in half.
What species of sharks are y'all dealing with?
It's hard. A lot of them are
sandbar sharks. I know they kind of come up around that area. They're very migratory as well. Matter of fact, we get massive migrations of them down where I'm at. Talking about, there's some videos of them in like the Keys and stuff where it's like, I mean, it looks like miles and miles of sharks eating everything.
Yeah, I think a lot of it's sandbar. We get some spinner sharks, some sand tigers. But as far as the ones in Montauk, I don't know. I'd like to think we're just dealing with sandbars, but there was last year a question of them being some bull sharks around. Some of the commercial guys were claiming they were getting bull sharks in their nets and ripping up their nets right by the shore. So I have one video where I went to a big rock purposely because I knew it was your feet wouldn't be out of the water, but you'd still be in deep water. So I wanted to film some of this because it's crazy. Me and my buddies were having these just close calls every night, and there's no video or whatever. So I had a good fish on it. It was probably in the high 30s or something like that. It got bit. I turned the light on, and it was like a feeding frenzy of them, and they just came and went. I at one point I counted about seven in my sight. Around my rock, they try and headbutt your rock. It's definitely a new aspect, totally new aspect. You know, you'll get the old timers that say, "Oh, there was always, you know, there's always sharks in the ocean," but it's just there's a lot of.
That's been a big. That's actually it's a massive topic in my neck of the woods right now. That is like the hot button topic, especially around like the 10,000 Islands, the Everglades, Flamingo area. Deep South Florida. That's a big thing right now. Sharks are just taking everybody's catches. That's kind of the shitty thing too. It's like we pattern a fish the same way that we can pattern and predict certain things for fish. Soak in the sharks, soak in the apex predators. And maybe this is getting to a point where they're learning like, dinner time, here's a fisherman. All I got to do is wait by his feet. They do that by the boats down here. They know what the boat is. The barracudas do it. In some areas on the reefs, the Goliath groupers do it. They'll wait below your boat. I'm going to wait here for your fish because they're, you know, it's nothing you can do but move. But, I've seen at least one of your videos of a shark smoking a fish right at your feet. And it kind of got me wondering.
I agree with you. We get the seals too. Seals are a little smarter, but they'll follow you along the beach. Seals, you know, you'll get into some fish and you'll start walking and they'll bob their heads and kind of follow you around. And they know what's up. They know to follow the fishermen, the seals, but they're not as big of a problem as the sharks as far as taking fish. But I agree with you. I think, you know, one fish being caught is enough to spark, you know, bring everyone in from the neighborhood.
Yeah. Well, what defense mechanism do you even have? Just butt stroke them? Smack them with the rod? I mean,
that's the only thing I could think of. You know, I carry a dive knife and everything, a blunt tip and a sharp one. I don't know, whack him in the nose, something like that.
Jeez.
I know a couple years ago, it's a funny story. I was far out, and there was a couple other guys closer in. And there was some fish around, and this was shark time of year, but this was like 4 years ago, so it wasn't as prevalent. But I got fucking smacked in the leg, like took my leg out, like from under me. And like you said, my instinct was to butt it around. I ended up swimming in, and the kid behind me is like, "Yo," he's like, "I just had a 30-pound fish go into you. Are you good?" So it was actually a bass.
Oh, it was his fish. Yeah.
So there's a couple of guys behind me catching a bigger fish than.
Oh yeah. The last thing I want to feel when I'm in the water, something touched my leg. It's probably just like a damn mullet or something small, but I don't like when things that I can't see touch me. Whether it's a bug or something much bigger, but the sharks, I get the hazard. It's probably the more interesting conversation, but more I think it's like the environmental conditions. When I watch those videos of people standing on rocks and these breakers are like smashing over you, you know what I mean? I wonder, like, what safety precautions do you really have in place? You know what I mean? I don't know what you can really do to prepare. I mean, how are you staying on the rocks? I'm watching these videos of these guys it's almost like that's just par for the course. Every fifth wave is going to knock you down. You're going to have to climb back up on the same rock numerous times. But what are you doing to protect? I mean, you're not out there in a helmet. You know what I mean? Like,
a lot of it's knowing what's behind you. And that's actually an advantage of swimming out it's a safer aspect because all the time what's behind you is just going to be a pool of water. Most guys get hurt getting wiped off a wave close in and they fall back and they hit their head or they hit their whatever, their knees or their feet get stuck in the rocks. So I would say knowing what's behind you, if you're going to be fishing these, if you're in conditions that are some nasty waves, you're getting wiped off. You got to be careful of what's behind you because that's where you're getting thrown into. Like nor'easters are in these big storms. You can't go out far.
Yeah.
Because you can't. So a lot of the times it's going to be close in. Sometimes I always naturally, if I'm getting like, sometimes a wave will get you where it's going to body, like it just catches you right. And it's going to throw you, like just keep taking you the whole way. So I'll go like this sometimes. You cover the back of your head. Oh. But as far as staying on the rocks, it's definitely a learned, you know, technique. There's no really explaining it. You really got to do it. It's a lot of duck diving. You know, you'll have a 5-foot wave come in front of you. And it's a sight to see, actually. It's a cool thing. And you could duck dive into it and just get thrown back onto it standing and just never miss a beat, like while you're fishing. Yeah. And that's definitely one of the cooler ones. Just lowering your shoulder sometimes, like a lineman with some of these rocks. So sometimes it's just one of those nights that every other wave is going to Ric Flair slap you in the face. And it's just, you get so upset.
Oh, geez. Well, yeah, I don't even know what to say about that kind of stuff. That's one of those things where I'll listen to, it seems like mostly I'll listen to like the older guys talk about that scene. Some of the videos that I've been watching and, is there like a consensus? It's obviously it's a changing scene and you've even alluded to it. They're like, not many more people are wanting to get into it. So, I don't want the tone of the conversation to start sounding negative. But like, what is the consensus? Like, does the fishing seem to be getting better or worse? Is it like, is the fishing as good as it? Obviously, you haven't been around forever. You can only go based off of anecdotes from old timers. And it's everywhere I ever go, people who used to fish a lot will always say that things are way better back in the old days. But like, what is the idea around that area as far as the future of the fishery, where it used to be compared to where it is now? Does the fishing seem better? Maybe there's just less anglers. What's the status right now of that area?
So it's hard because with the dwindling population, it affects the way they stay together and migrate. So now you'll get, instead of like months and months of fish coming by, you'll get, or months, or just big bodies of fish, you'll have concentrated bodies of fish where people, if they get into it, that's the best action they've ever had in their life. But there's only a couple of those bodies, you know. That's what I think is happening the past couple of years, because I've gotten into some really good bites, and I asked some of the old timers that have been, and they're like, wow, that's the best top water bite I've seen my whole life in Montauk. And I think what you're getting is just all those big fish, you know, in a conglomerate instead of spread out. That's just the way it is. But I think overall, the population, you know, is not doing too good. And I think it should start improving with all these regulations. But yeah.
Yeah. It's always interesting when you start trying to forecast what a fishery is going to become like. It's because at the same time, is there like less people doing that kind of fishing? I mean, is there less pressure on the fish at least? Or is it still people are all over them?
So there's definitely less pressure, I'd say, from, I don't know, it's hard to tell. One thing would be the recreational boat, the for hire boat guys. Like I was saying, that bass will set up residency in the summer. They'll stay in Montauk the whole summer. So you'll get those charter boats that'll go out three times a day, every day, the whole entire summer, and guaranteed they kill four slot monster fish every trip, you know, or whatever it is. So that's a lot of pressure on those fish. And I think part of the reason the fishing's been pretty good in Montauk is that those fish just can't get slaughtered. Whatever fish show up, they usually get picked off by the time we get to them, but they can't be killed. So they're just hanging around.
Yeah, because that's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking like long-term cause and effect of stuff. It's like, oh, it's so tragic that, you know, maybe there's less people fishing now, but maybe that's going to mean a much more fruitful fishery in the future, which will in turn invite a lot more people in to want to experience. And it's like, you know, I don't know. Historically there, it seems like Montauk has just been considered always a fishing town. So I don't know if they've had these ebbs and flows or if it's just a recent time of less interest in that style of thing. That's just, I mean, I think it's the newer generation of people not wanting to go do this hazards of being on my back porch. I got the damn mosquitoes coming out here.
That's why, you know, me and, you know, a lot of the companies and a lot of the guys are trying to talk up catch and release to make, you know, guys getting into it get as serious as they were into fishing with catch and release. Because, you know, you talk to some of these guys and it's just depressing. They say, oh, it used to be so great. They'll never, you know, we used to bring in the 50 weighing it in. There'll never be those days. But I don't know, man. I still have a lot of days ahead of me, like a lot of eras ahead of me that we got to make something.
Yeah.
Great. You know, we can't just let it die off. No interest in the sport, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. You see that, I mean, I've seen scenarios like that in the fishing that I've done around my areas where it's like, there's merit to that type of complaining. I don't want to call it complaining, but there's merit to that type of sentiment where people are like, oh, it's just not what it used to be. It's in decline.
Yeah.
But then in other situations, I'm like, I'm still catching fish, but you're just still doing the same thing that you used to be doing.
Yeah.
And it's like any fisherman knows you can't keep doing the same freaking thing your entire life. You've never adapted. You never changed. You never tried something new. It's like, well, did the fish really leave or did they just adapt to that same old way of fishing? So it's like, yeah, it's like you got to dig in and find the truth there. But sometimes I think it's easier for people who don't fish anymore to say, it ain't what it used to be. So yeah, it's such a depressing conversation when I hear that. And it's like, I've definitely seen scenarios where I'm like, no, dude, you just, the fish outsmarted your old ass. And then I've seen other situations where it's like, yeah, it's, you know, they installed a dam up here. You got development out the ass over here. When you talk about Florida fishing, I mean, dude, I'm not a born and raised Floridian. I've only been here for 7 years, but even in the amount of time I've been here, it is shocking. I mean, they're just jamming new buildings and new developments everywhere they can possibly mow down another section of another acreage of trees and stuff. I'm like, yeah, just cramming their way into the natural stuff. So it's like they're definitely in effect. But, you know, I know I'd actually seen your post. I think it was one of your stories. I don't think it was a post. I was been keeping up with your stories where they were closing that Polly's place. You know, I even saw that in that video that I was talking about. I was like, oh, that's that bait shop that he put in his story. You know, that kind of stuff's sad because it's, you know, is that symbolic of changing times in the area? I'd listen to that video and they're like, oh, we've always kept, you know, Montauk has always kept the ritzy fancy neighborhood is just like just on the other side, or it's like it's knocking at the door. Is it getting to a point where they've crept in?
It's, you know what it is. It's not even the rich. It's the tourism.
Oh, okay.
Like people that are permanent residents of Montauk are, you know, it's a small percentage, you know, that stay the whole winter. Some statistic, like it doubles in size in the summer or something like that. So that's what the changing era is there's a lot of tourism. There's a lot of, you go in the summer, the streets is like Times Square. You got people fighting.
Oh, yeah.
It just turns into this rowdy, like, but it is changing. And that's part of the reason, you know, places are closing and old local, you know, before my time, like way back when, it was like local, you know, like you knew everyone in town, you knew all the fishermen. And then when I started, it was still a little bit tight knit, but it started getting worse every year with just the amount of hooligans out there.
Yeah.
Ruining it, right? You can't even go to 7-Eleven without, you know, on a Saturday night to get a coffee without people fighting or yelling or.
Yeah.
So.
Jeez.
For sure out there.
Yeah. Well, that area always entertains me because it's like y'all still have like legends.
Yeah.
There's like recognized names. I look at some of the guys that I know from that area and it's like, they talk about, I can't think of these people's names, but it's like, there's like people who have ascended to this like legendary status. Like, oh, that's Salty Cracker Bill. And that's all. That's Wet Boots McGee. Like it's like these crazy names and stuff. And I think that's just the tackle store. That's kind of like the sad thing is like, those are always like the guys that ascended that level with their name echoed through the local tackle shop and like reached this crazy level. But, you know, I wonder if you ever kind of rub shoulders with some of these people that everybody talks about.
Yeah. I mean, definitely, some of the guys that are still in the tournament, that are a few generations before my time are definitely some heavy hitters, but a lot of the names you're referring to, like, though that's prior to my generation, they don't fish, but we have a couple legends still going at it. And that's why I hope people still do it. I don't want, cause then it means nothing. If nobody gives a shit, then,
Yeah, that's interesting. There was things that I kind of skipped over, maybe for the best. Like you had started to, I like was going to talk about the skishing thing. Yeah. I remember like, I don't know, man. I think I might have been in like college. This might have been around like 2005, 2006 or so. I was like, the skishing craze was like all over the internet. I'm like, what the hell is this? Like, I don't remember where I saw it. Maybe it was the early days of YouTube, like when that first came out. Maybe it was on TV somewhere. But I'm like, is there really like a scene for that? Or is this sort of like a taboo thing that nobody's really doing? Or it's like, you know, they're floating around with flippers on their feet, like literally swimming and letting the fish pull them out to sea. Nobody's really doing that anymore. Like,
no, but people did do it in, you know, in the early 2000s, late 90s. It was popular, but I don't, I've never really seen anyone do it. I don't do it because the sharks, even the old timers, wouldn't.
Yeah.
It would get shredded. There's nights that if you went swimming out there and you had a fish on your line, you would just get shredded apart. Like, it's just,
yeah. I wouldn't want to be swimming out there. You know, it's probably the naive thing to think. It's the same stuff people say, like, if you live in Florida, you don't want to, oh, what about alligators?
Yeah.
Even when you're actually around, I'm like, it's like, that's nothing. It's like seeing a turtle or a bird. But my concern would be if a seal was there. Because I'm like, I look like a seal out here. Now you're just like, now you are a seal. Surely whatever's eating them is out there, but maybe not. I don't know. Y'all's water just looks more like it's dirty and more uncertain, like what might be down there. Like you can't see it coming, especially if you're out at night. I don't know. I just can't think about that. But, you know, one thing that I didn't touch on, I always do a bad job with this. I never talk enough about like how you're doing it, or like the gear involved. But like I think about the absolute beating that your gear has to take. Like you're in the salt water. It's all in your reel. It's all in your gear. It's getting it all in your shit. Whatever kind of tools that you might be using to dehook the fish is just exposed to the elements to the highest degree. I mean, if I guess we're going to give a quick rundown, like on what your setup looks like, because if you're poking the bottom and your rod's banging against rocks and constant exposure to sand blasting it and salt getting into it, what is your setup that you're typically using from rod to line to reel and things like that?
So a lot of it was trial and error over the years, just stuff not lasting and just getting sick of it. But my rod, I use a Lamaglass rod, 11 foot. But the thing that would make it unique is, I guess, the bottom. I have, I don't know what you call it, gimbals, they call it, like the boat cap. There's a cap they put on it, and it's just made for a cap. I use that as a rod butt, actually. It's like a big, thick rubber cap that I use, you know, to help a lot of walking and pushing into the rocks. The reels we use are Van Stalls, which are water sealed reels. They got nothing out there really lasts besides Van Stalls. Line, you got to use Overkill in Montauk because of all the rocks. So I use 50-pound braid and 80-pound mono as my leader.
Yeah.
You can get away with a lot lighter technically for the fish you're fishing after, but you know, so those fish are smart. They take you into the rocks, they shred your line. Footwear, that model of corkers I was talking about, that's the only one that I've noticed is year after year is I'm still able to use it because it's this tough rubber. Wetsuit. You go through a lot of wetsuit, mainly the knees, because you're always jumping up and down on the rocks. And I really should wear knee pads instead of, but I get a couple new wetsuits every year. I just go through. dive lights. We use a diver's, headlamp or neck lamp, as you would call it, and you just have a string around your neck or a lanyard around your neck when you wear it there. Waterproof watches. I'm trying to think. Pliers, titanium Van Stalls pliers. Those are pretty good. Those, I've never had to change my pliers with those. But just everything just gets beat up, like you're saying. Even Van Stalls, they're waterproof. But when I bring them to get serviced, they're like, I never seen this. What the fuck do you do to this? I'm like, Reunite, this thing is underwater.
Yeah. Are you just like locking down on these fish too? That's the other thing I'm thinking. I don't know how light you're really even able to play the fish, because that's another element. I mean, if a 50-pound striper starts pulling on lockdown drag and you're standing on some slippery rock, you know,
I've gotten pulled off a couple times, but you gotta fish a tighter drag than you would on the sand beaches. You know, some guys, they could just, if there's no one around them, you could play with the fish on the sand all day if you want. But
yeah,
rocks and the current, and now the sharks in the summer, you got to get that thing in pretty fast. But yeah, sometimes you get ripped, you get a, you know, big hook set on it, you know, live eel or something, you get ripped off sometimes, and that's hard to get back on. I've had that happen a few times with big fish. You get ripped off, and now you're getting pulled in. What I would do, I just dump my drag all the way down loose and I just swim back to the rock with minimal tension and just hope the fish is still there.
Yeah. Are you fishing, like, with the hours that you're committed to doing this? I feel like I, like, missed so many things I should have established early in the conversation. See, this is why I'm a bad host. I just meander and don't stay on topic. But I'm thinking, like, the hours that you're out there, are you in, like, odd hours, like 3 a.m? We're out there for 10 hours. Like, what are the sessions looking like? You know what I mean? Like, because then I'm thinking, you got to be, like, pounding energy drinks and coffee just to stay alive out there.
Yeah, it's all fire. It's all energy drinks, and it's all nighttime, you know? It's really dependent on tide. And if it's a high tide bite, and high tide's at 9 p.m. when you find the bite, and then it's 10 p.m. the next night, 11, and then before you know it, you're driving out there at 1 a.m. to fish, you know, 2:30, whatever it is, and then sometimes you get this, you know, once it's the summer and you get those really, really short nights. I've done it where you sit on the same rock, you see the sun go down, and then you see it come up again, you know.
Oh, just, my gosh.
Those are the nights you're like, oh, fuck, man.
You know, because that brings up one of the big curious points I had when I look at a wetsuit. And I know my body system. Like, if I'm pounding coffees and energy drinks, my bladder and my digestive system start acting up real quick. if you're out there stranded on some rock and some breakers in a wetsuit, I'm like, how's this guy take a shit? How's this guy got to take a piss? You just hang your ass off the rock? And I mean, like, what are you doing?
Hold no, it. No one should.
Let her rip. Just let her go.
I guess if you really had to, but we piss in the wetsuit all night long every night.
Yeah, that's what I figured.
Yeah, it's just that they go through them fast too. They smell so fucking bad. you gotta flush it out. But yeah, that's actually an advantage of wearing the wetsuit. You're out there running and take all your shit off just to piss, but wetsuit, you fucking go.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, geez. I probably could have guessed that. I might do that in my regular pants from time to time. But, man, Brandon, I think I've exhausted a lot of the questions that I had. You know what I mean? Like, we covered more than we ought to have covered. I mean, you know, there's going to be a couple of people that are like, you didn't ask this or that. probably not. But, yeah, dude, that style of fishing, like I said, man, I look at styles of fishing all over the freaking world, but that's one that's like, I wouldn't necessarily want to do that all the time, but it's like, it's a style of fishing I'd love to see before it's all said and done. So maybe when I make it happen, you'll be the guy that I call. But you know, I don't know how to time that. I don't know how to predict that. I don't know when the windows are. It may very well just be a long session of getting wet and catching nothing. But yeah, dude, your photos, granted, we kind of talked about it before we started. You're not one of these Instagram hoes that's trying to post every single thing that you do. And it's not smart. You don't want to post everything and then blow up your areas, blow up your spots, or let the whole world know when the bite's on. But people that want to see this stuff, your photos where you're, I don't even like a lot of your photos that aren't even you holding a fish, where it's just the elements. I'm like, God bless.
Yeah, there's a couple cool shots you get in a nor'easter, especially. I've had, you know, you're lucky. I remember one of them on my Instagram, it was a photo shoot for a rod company. And the guy just got this sick shot of just like an 8-foot wave in front of me, just like all these waves. an experience. It's definitely.
Well, regardless, where people would want, like, if people wanted to go check that stuff out, or some of the stuff that you've written, I found a couple of the articles that you've written. I'd even had one quote here. I think we touched on it though. You had like this quote that's about mental and physical obedience to operate in that lifestyle. I was like, what an awesome series of words to say. But we touched on that a little bit. But where can people find you? You know what I mean? Like, what's some good resources to actually check out the truth or like the reality of that lifestyle and that kind of fishing, whether it be the articles that you've written, good magazines people can check out, or like your Instagram if people want to check that out.
I would just say Instagram, because I would usually share the articles. They're in the Fisherman magazine usually. I think one's coming out in June, and On the Water magazine. I'm sure if you just Google my name, it might come up with links to the articles and whatnot. But I've done a couple, you know, interesting pieces on just like kind of like we talked about today. Nothing like from an outsider's point of view, what, you know, what am I doing? Yeah. So there's a few of those articles. And I did an article about competitive surf casting, just like what goes into it. That might have been what that quote was from. But yeah. I'd say Instagram, or I don't really have it. Facebook, I guess.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to put the Instagram thing up on here, probably in a link. What is the handle for anybody that's listening, who probably driving and playing on their phone?
B Saucily 42.
So, you know, I'll put that in the description. If anybody's watching the YouTube, which most people don't, they don't want to watch two dudes looking at each other talking. Most people just listen. But I can put that up on there. I didn't lose you.
Yeah, let me double. Sorry, it's B Saucy. I thought it was something different. That's good.
Yeah. Well, dude, I appreciate your time. This was one I was really looking forward to because the stuff you're doing. Granted, I love talking to everybody I've talked to, but a lot of it's like off the wall stuff or suggestions that somebody gave me. I'm like, okay, well, you know, I wasn't really thinking about that style of fishing, but somebody I'd be willing to talk to. There's an audience for everything, but yours was one that I saw your stuff. I'm like, I want to talk to that guy. Like I am actually interested in what he does. And as tribal as that scene of fishing is, where it's all kind of in-house and everybody knows everybody, there's definitely people like me who are on the outside that don't know anything about it, looking in like, damn, maybe it's just the adventurous lifestyle type of people. But I was like, that's something I want to see more of. So, man, I appreciate your time. You're a fun one. And we'll definitely be in touch if I'm ever up in that area. I think in due time that's going to happen. I just got to quit leaving the country and focus on the fishery we have in the U.S., which is really, when you think about it, it's really probably the best in the world, the most diverse country by country. But yeah, man, what you do is awesome. And yeah, for Brandon, sure. I appreciate your time, and we'll be in touch off the record.
Yeah, for sure.
All right, man, take it easy.
Later, Dave.
Thank you for listening to Boundless Pursuit. Tune in each week as we bring stories and insight from uniquely talented anglers and outdoorsmen. And if you enjoyed this show, I want to hear from you. Be sure to leave a 5-star review, as this is going to drive the growth and exposure of this show. And if you have feedback or guest suggestions, I would love to hear from you. And you can reach me at boundlesspursuitfishing@gmail.com. For all other collections of media and contact information, please visit www.boundless-pursuit.com.